Hello, guys. Welcome to this first ever Booth and Dixon Big Fight Companion. This is something Adam and I have been talking about doing for, I think, years. We've talked about doing breakdowns and analysis. In fact, we did used to flirt with the idea of doing it with Alex Arthur, but geographically, Alex is a bit out of the equation, being so far north of the border. But just to say who we are, I'm an average journalist who's been covering the sport for 20 years, and Adam's a top trainer who's been in the sport for more than 20 years, more like 30, I think. Just as he turns his phone to silent. But we're here talking about this weekend's big fight, the heavyweight rematch between Deontay Wilder and Tyson Fury. The idea is that we offer something kind of unique, something that's not really out there at the moment, a big fight breakdown in podcast form. And if you want to take it a little bit further, the morning after the big fight, there'll be a YouTube video of Adam and I breaking down the big fight. In fact, even watching the big fight from the comfort of his, I was going to say studio, but it's sort of study area.
It's a TV room.
That is, of course, Adam Booth. And without further ado, we'll get into the nitty-gritty. And I've used my pen and marked things off because there's a lot of questions going into this fight. And that's why these big fights are so alluring, because we need the answers to the questions. To start off with, Tyson is talking about coming in and being more physical and being stronger in this fight and forcing a stoppage. Is that the old bait and switch thing? Is he leading Wilder to believe one thing and going to do something else? Or do you think that could be the game plan?
With Tyson, anything he says, you can't take it on face value, because sometimes he's talking straight and other times he's trying to lead you down a path. So his words could mean one or the opposite. The fact that he's training with Sugar Hill and Andy Lee with the crunk mentality leads me to believe that regardless of whether he's saying he's bigger and stronger, his mindset towards it may be more crunk-like. And the Emmanuel Stewart and the crunk gym were known for tall, long-armed fighters who were aggressive in their manner, you know, born out of Tommy Hearns. And I think maybe that's the change that Tyson might make if what he's referring to is his approach to the fight.
It's an interesting one, because, like you say, Tyson's got those long limbs, and Emmanuel Stewart was a guy who was never a passenger in the corner. And you mentioned those aggressive tendencies, particularly with someone like Lennox, who was a bit more passive. You remember the fights against David Tuer, where he was urging Lennox to really go for him instead of just out jabbing him, and particularly against Mike Tyson, when he really wanted Tyson to be put away earlier than he actually was. But that's one thing when Emmanuel Stewart's saying it. It's another thing when Sugar Hill, who might have that Kronk name behind him, but he doesn't have that, he doesn't have the same Hall of Fame credentials that Emmanuel Stewart had.
No, when Andy Lee first came over to me and we had lots of conversations, and the one thing I identified with Andy is that we needed to develop his technical and emotional composure defensively. One of the first things he said to me was that Emmanuel always liked his fighters to try and test the other guy's chin in the first round. That mentality, that crunk mentality of asserting yourself. And that's what I think Tyson might do in this fight. It's certainly one of his options. I think he's going into this fight with more athletic momentum behind his career, whereas the first fight, he'd had that long period out and some meaningless activity before fighting, you know, one of the most feared heavyweights in the world, if not the most feared heavyweight in the world. And I remember seeing Tyson in Monaco when he was, I think he met with Eddie, and he was talking about how to structure his comeback from where he'd been. And I remember looking at him thinking, that's a long journey he's got. I don't see how anyone is going to lose that much weight and get themselves together to compete at that level again. But he did. And the first time around, he did it with Deontay coming off that period of athletic disability and inactivity and emotional trauma. This time round, I think there's a lot more momentum behind him, as well as the confidence of what went down in the first fight. The fight was close, but I remember the feeling when I was watching it, having that feeling that Deontay needed a knockout to win the fight it when it was going into the last round. And so my judgment on it was that Tyson won it. It was a close fight, but that Tyson won it. This time round, I think that both of them know each other. They've done the dance. Once you've shared the ring with someone for 12 rounds, you get a feel for them, for their movements, for where you negated them, for where you had success, for where they had success, and you start to make little adjustments when you go back. Most of the time, the second fight always nearly goes the same way as the first fight in terms of who wins. But in this one, I think it's a lot different. I think that both of them are going to make adjustments. I have a sneaky suspicion that this fight's not going the distance. I think they both believe they can hurt the other one, and I think with Deontay, undoubtedly, you know he's going to try and take Tyson's head off. That's what he does. With Tyson, he knows that he can outbox Deontay. He knows that defensively, he's got the flow and the movement and the rhythm and the mobile balance to negate Deontay's aggression and make a lot of his attacks look quite novice-like. But also, he did stun Deontay a few times in that first fight, and I think that with more confidence and more strength and more momentum behind him, I think that that's possibly something that Tyson's going to focus on.
We hear this a lot. Is Wilder a one-trick pony?
When you say a one-trick pony, you could probably say that about a lot of heavyweights. You could say that about George Foreman. You could say about Ernie Shavers. You know, you could say it when you refer to someone's style or attributes in the heavyweight division, because they're big men, they grow up with, as big men, the majority of them don't need to develop the little sort of nuances that the smaller fighters have to.
But it's more so with Wilder because there seems to be a big gap, and I might be wrong, but between his skill set and his punching power. So it means that where I'm coming from with this is when you talk about a George Foreman, he might have other attributes that are 7 out of 10, but his power is a 10 out of 10. With Wilder, people think that his skills are a 1 out of 10 and his abilities are 0 out of 10, but he's got this punch, which is Thor's hammer, which is a 13 out of 10. And I think that's where the discrepancy comes from. The other people tick a lot of boxes and are steady across the board, but Wilder's got this one thing that he can always pull out the hat, seemingly.
But Deontay medaled at the Olympics, didn't he?
After very few amateur fights.
After having boxed for 1 year. He had taken up boxing, and a year later he medaled at the Olympics. So you can't say that he doesn't have a boxing brain or boxing grade, because he wouldn't have done that as an amateur. I think that as a pro, he has evolved into his character, his public character as a fighter, and where he'd had such a massive string of knockouts, he developed that sort of puncher's mentality and probably negated some of the things that he had when he was younger and when he was an amateur. It's not to say that he doesn't have the skill set, but he believes that he can focus on limited skill sets and have success. And he has a good argument because he's unbeaten after how many fights now? So, and WBC heavyweight champion. So you can kind of forgive him for going with what worked rather than spinning too many plates. If you just got one and that one's working for you, why change it? If it's not broke, why fix it? But I think what the Tyson fight showed, and also his last fight against Ortiz,
yep.
Is that he can be outboxed and that he can't just clench his fist and swing it hard. That people aren't just going to leave their chins there for him, that he's going to have to set it up. He lost every round against Ortiz before landing one shot. And that was because Ortiz stood static and fell asleep for a second. With Tyson, he's got a bigger man with longer arms and a better defensive flow. So he's going to have to make adjustments to land the shots that he wants to land. So in answer to your question, he may be going with the limited skill sets and not spinning too many plates, but because it's worked for him up until now, he hasn't been forced to change it. But I think the first fight might make him readjust how he goes about trying to land his shots.
Yeah, because the question is, what happens when that punch isn't enough? What happens?
Well, it's not necessarily when the punch isn't enough. It's when you can't land it.
Yeah, sure.
Because if you're landing and it's not hurting
that skill isn't enough, but yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's the setup for it. And it's Tyson was very nervous at the start of the first fight and was using a lot of little fidgety feints. He was burning up a lot of energy. But I noticed that the little twitch, Deontay was buying everything that Tyson did. So every little twitch he did, Deontay reacted to. And I think that made Deontay second guess when to go and when not to go. And
Deontay burning just as much energy in reacting to the feints as Tyson was.
Maybe not even burning energy, but choking up physically, where he didn't know whether he was going to be there because the target was moving so much that he didn't know whether to let the heavy shots go. And I think that Tyson can look at that knowing that he's got that flow and that he can repeat that flow round after round, and that flow unsettled someone who likes a very static balance. Deontay likes to hold his legs and throw his hands hard. And as soon as you make him move, the weakness in his legs that he has, because they're so long and skinny and he doesn't have the same control over them as someone that might be more athletically built with the legs, gets exposed.
Wilder's often the taller man at 6'7". Here he's not. Should he fight long?
Well, he's got no choice. I mean, he's not an inside fighter. You know, it's not like he makes himself small, shifts his head, works his way in low and hooks to the body and hooks to the head. That's not his style. He likes to stand upright, stand long, set up with the jab and throw the big booming right hand. He's a long range fighter, and so is Tyson. Sometimes when you get two guys as proficient as they can be at their level, if you've got two guys who are always used to being the bigger guy, when you match them with someone of equal stature, they can look a little bit novice-y. I remember when Lennox Lewis fought Vitaly Klitschko, and it looked quite cumbersome as a fight, because their normal physical advantages were neutralized because the other guy had the same. And I think there's an element of that here.
Yeah, I think we saw that probably with some Akin one day fights and stuff where you just see arms and legs.
Yeah. I mean, Henry was an absolute freak and was very mobile. But nowadays, there's a lot more bigger guys. You know, heavyweights in general are taller and heavier now.
Body shots didn't really come into play too much in the first fight. Was there a reason behind that, do you think? And do you think one of the guys should focus on the body a bit more than they did? Should Deontay look to Tyson's body to take away his movement? Should Fury look to Deontay's body to try and take away some of the power and some of the strength?
If I was coaching Deontay, absolutely, I wouldn't get him to headhunt too much, especially when Tyson's being fidgety and mobile. I'd get him to take a big step to distance and bang a long, hard straight to the chest or the ribs or the hip or anything. Yes, you've got to do that, because there's nothing like hitting the body hard to stop the head moving so much. I wouldn't encourage Tyson to go to Deontay's body, because in doing so, he's just going to end up closer to him. And because Tyson's not naturally heavy-handed like Deontay is, the change that he's going to get from landing body shots wouldn't be the same.
Fury was badly cut by Otto Wallin in his last fight over his right eye. Is that a concern for you moving into this fight?
Depends how he's gone about having it treated. If he just let the cut heal and didn't have any sort of strengthening plastic surgery done under the skin, then yes, that it could certainly be a factor in the fight if it gets touched, because a cut that bad, you know, not a long time after it initially happened, could be a factor. But you can get plastic surgeons now who will open up a wound like that, and what they do is they insert a little mesh into the soft tissue, and then all the scar tissue forms around the mesh, and the mesh gives a broader surface area of attachment. If he's done something like that, it could help him. If he hasn't, if it's just healed naturally, then of course a cut like that could always reopen.
He's hired Stitch Duran for this fight, so that indicates that he's trying to cover that base as best as possible. It was Javier Capetillo who looked after it for the Volin fight, and there were mixed reports on Capetillo. I mean, the fact that Tyson stayed in the fight means that he did his job, but there were some people that said that he made a dog's dinner of it, and it should have been resolved far quicker than it was. I mean, I'll leave people to make up their own minds on that. But in terms of the facial swelling and people busting up, Wilder was actually busting up a bit in that first fight, and he was swelling up around the eyes and stuff. That's something that Fury can look to do in this fight, isn't it? By getting him on the end of the jab and pouring away in his face like he does with that left hand in particular.
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about distracting him with his long left hand, the way that sometimes he flicks it, sometimes he puts a hard right hand behind it and disguising what he's doing, that's fine. But if you're relying on facial damage to play out in his favour, Deontay hasn't really suffered that. The facial damage that we were talking about with Tyson was that serious cut. Going with Stitch Duran, he's obviously going with a proven entity. And you know, he's got phenomenal experience working world championship fights, working cuts, and will have a catalogue of serious cuts that he's had to deal with. So I think stepping into a fight like this, knowing or believing that you've ticked all the boxes and that you've got the best man for each individual job, can only help fuel your confidence.
Do Otto Wallin, Thomas Schwartz, Brazil and Luis Ortiz, the rematch, do they mean anything, the fights that they've had in the interim? Have either of them learned anything, or is it just been about building this fight and the guy's basically treading water for a year?
I think it certainly means a lot for Tyson, because like I said, he went into that first fight without that athletic momentum behind his career. You know, anyone that's boxed and competed in the amateur as a pro, you know that the more you spar and the more regularly you box, you just seem to have more of an edge about your work. Your concentration is better, your reactions are better, you're just more conditioned to competition. So I certainly think that being active in between the two fights for Tyson is definitely going to help Tyson. The Ortiz fight for Deontay, yeah, okay, he put him to sleep with that one shot, but he looked lost technically through the fight, Deontay did. And so that's, I think, should be the catalyst for him developing his setups and not just relying on the one shot, but using a boxing brain and some stepping movements and some boxing skills to set up the shots that he wants to land.
Deontay thinks he won the first fight. I don't know if that's just talk or not. Maybe he legitimately does. But one thing he conceded was that he was rushing his punches in that first fight and the occasion got to him a little bit. Is that something that he can learn from now? He has had that big super fight, because people were saying he hadn't had these defining fights. The Fury fight was really his first big dance in that respect. So is that something that he will not do this time? Do you think you can almost guarantee that he's learned that lesson?
What is that? It's the fact that he's been in there with him for 12 rounds. Trying to find someone in preparation for a fight against Tyson Fury, trying to find someone that's that size with that length arms, with the short spine like Tyson's got, with that movement, with that mental game that he plays, you can't replicate it. So
because you tried with David, didn't you? You were training David at the time when you had the
But Tyson's so much more of a fighter now than he was back then.
Sure.
You know, he's kind of proved himself to himself. I think that the Tyson Fury that David Haye was getting ready for wasn't a patch on the fighter that he is now. But the question was about Deontay. The best preparation that Deontay has going into this fight is the first fight. The answers for both of them exist in that first fight. And like I said, now that he's spent 12 rounds with him and he's kind of got used to that style a little bit and caught up with him in the last round, I think if he feeds on that and realizes the little things he had to try and do to land the shots that he wanted, he can certainly carry that into this fight and have a bit more of a knowing about how to address Tyson Fury.
Using your boxing politics brain, maybe even your manager's head here, is there a chance that Tyson Fury doesn't win as widely as people thought he did the first time, but he still gets a decision, as we saw with Lennox Holyfield? The first fight was a draw, and then people thought the second fight was actually closer, but Lennox won quite handily on the scorecards because they wanted to right the wrong from the first fight. That was a consensus. I'm not saying that's what happened, but do you think there's that thing where Fury maybe goes in with that kind of advantage, that the fact that people thought there was an injustice the first time?
A close decision doesn't mean a bad decision. That first fight wasn't a wide score. Yes, I thought that Tyson edged it. I thought that Deontay needed a stoppage win in that last round. But each round was close. It was a close fight. Whoever you believe won, it was a close fight. So you're not screaming robbery. And both of them have commercial value. Deontay has commercial value with PBC. And Tyson's got commercial value in America and the UK territory. So I don't think the business will favour the winner. I don't think it, as far as the business is concerned, it doesn't matter who the winner is. If it's Tyson and they don't do a rematch, Tyson against Anthony Joshua becomes the biggest fight in world boxing. If it's Deontay and Tyson doesn't want the rematch, Deontay against Anthony Joshua is the biggest fight in world boxing. So I don't think, in terms of numbers, I'm not sure that it matters to the business who wins. So that shouldn't be a factor.
Yeah, so I spoke to Bob Arum about the rematch just when I was over in Vegas a couple of weeks ago, and Bob said that the rematch is stacked 60-40 in favour of the winner, and the loser will have the choice whether he wants to take the rematch for that 40%. So it'll be down to the loser whether he wants to invoke that clause, but if he doesn't want to swallow the 40% and he thinks he's worth more than that, he can move on. So you may see the loser fight Joshua.
No, or the loser can negotiate a position, allow the winner to go and fight Joshua on the understanding that the winner of Joshua and the winner fights the loser in their subsequent fight. You can always negotiate your position.
You'd like to think so.
I think for boxing, if they do have that rematch clause, for boxing, if there is a conclusive winner in this fight on Saturday night, for boxing, it would be a good thing, and possibly financially for the loser, it would be a good thing to use that contract to negotiate the position and say, fine, I'll allow you to go and fight AJ on the understanding that the winner of that fight then defends against me.
Okay, that does make sense. It's talking sense. I like it. While I was out in the States, obviously I went to Alabama and spent some time with Wilder, again on the same trip with BT. And it was very interesting watching him hit the heavy bag. And you know those bags that people fill with water these days that are relatively new? He was using one of those in the gym, and he was hitting it so hard that the shutter doors were rattling in the gym, and people were like looking at it. It was a bit like, have you seen that bit in it? Is it, I want to say it's Kickboxer. Maybe it's Bloodsport, where Tong Po's kicking the wall and the cement's coming down.
Right.
It was kind of like that. It was almost eerie to see that power, because you know the human head's not built to take those sort of shots. Mm-hmm. Where I'm coming from with that is Wilder then spent a serious amount of time icing his hands afterwards. He said he'd hurt his hands before the Tyson Fury fight the first time, and that stopped him from throwing the right hand as much during sparring and practice in the build-up. It's not an issue he's had now, but the broken hand thing could be a wild card factor, couldn't it, in the fight?
Yes. Deontay he's not a heavy set heavyweight in terms of his bone structure. His bone structure is not thick and dense. It looks like it's quite long and lithe. And so because he generates so much force, he's going to be more susceptible to bone damage and hand injuries. But also, I know what these fighters can be like, and at this level, when they have this much determination and there's this much at stake, sometimes broken hands don't stop them punching to their maximum. They just worry about it afterwards. And I personally experienced that on a number of occasions with David Haye, when he's gone into significant fights with some significant damage to him, and it hasn't affected how he's gone about throwing his shots. Afterwards, he feels it, but with the adrenaline and everything going on, it didn't stop him.
One thing I like when you talk about boxing is balance. There are not many coaches that talk about it. This is interesting for numerous reasons. As Tyson is a big guy, but super coordinated, seems to be very well coordinated. Deontay seems a bit more gangly, but he generates this massive power. I'd be interested to know what you think about balance in terms of these guys, and whether Deontay, because he throws these bombs from outrageous angles, does he need to set himself, or is part of the danger the fact that he doesn't set himself and some of these punches do come from way out there?
Deontay needs to have that sturdy base to maximise his power. As soon as he makes that first move and his legs come off balance, you see that the shots don't seem to have the same impact. And a lot of the times they actually flap at the end of it when he doesn't have his feet underneath him. And that's what I mean by there's static balance and mobile balance. Statically, if the two of them hold their feet and trade, they're spinning a coin, I will favour Deontay. But if Tyson moves him, and that's what you got to do. When someone wants to set their feet and punch hard, you have to keep moving them. A bit like George Foreman, right? If you stood in front of George Foreman, he'll pound away. But when you make him move, he didn't seem to have the same force in his shots. And that certainly plays out even more with Deontay. So if they both hold their feet and go at it, Deontay's the harder puncher, and that type of behaviour suits him because it means he can hold his legs and hold his balance. He's got long, thin legs, and he does lose his balance sometimes quite drastically. And when all of a sudden the shots aren't heavy and dangerous and laser-like, the arms end up flapping. Whereas Tyson, we know, can be very effective while he's moving and picking shots. And even though he's not loading up with them, the fact that he's mobile while he's throwing them at any point, the shots are landing with his full weight behind them, even though he's not trying to generate a lot of force because he's moving with them.
from a boxing standpoint, who has the momentum? Who should be more confident going into this fight? Based on, because I suppose you'd look at the last fight and think, they both say that they won. So is it equal, or do you think one of them's kidding themselves, or do you think Fury shouldn't have that same confidence because he had to twice?
No, I think absolutely Fury should have more confidence than he had going into the first fight, because
even the fact that he knows he can be put down and hurt.
But yeah, but he already, I think he already knew that, right? He got put down by Steve Cunningham, a cruiserweight. So he knows he can be put down and he knows he can be hurt. Deontay knows he can be hurt. He's been hurt in fights before, but they get through it. If that, I don't see that as that, I don't see that playing out negatively in their mind's eye. I think Tyson certainly will carry more confidence, because the first fight, remember, he was going into that coming out from a, from an awful condition, physically, mentally, and emotionally. And to get and to go through that fight and win it, as he believes, and I believe he won it very closely, but I still think he won that first fight. If he can win that first fight under those circumstances, he's got to believe he wins his second fight, because he's got to be a better version of himself than he was going into that first fight. But then, if you look at Deontay, he's had the more meaningful fight in between, because he fought Ortiz, who is an absolute handful as a heavyweight.
Well, it might be a handful, though, mightn't he? Are we selling him
short? Yeah, but not with the same grade. Yeah, he might be a handful because he's a big fella that imposes himself, but not with the same grade as Ortiz. And Deontay slept him with a single shot, having lost six rounds. So I think Deontay can certainly pluck the confidence of that, and also the confidence of actually having shared the ring with Tyson Fury for 12 rounds and realizing, okay, this big man can move. He can make it awkward. He wasn't a static target. It was hard to find him. And I caught him with a good shot. I wouldn't say it was the shot that dropped Tyson in the 12th round. Wasn't on the button, but it was still a heavy shot. But I think Deontay believes he can land a better one. But Deontay's got to work on his setup and his movement before he throws it.
It has been all change in the Fury camp. While Wilder's been, he's still with the same people. He's still got Jay Diaz. He's still got Joey Scott. He's got Chris Bates, manager. Tyson has now
Mark
got...
Breland.
Is Mark Breland still there? Yeah, Mark's still there. I mean, he's got four pad men. He'd broken one of their hands when I was there. So that was one less. He was down to three. Whereas Tyson's changed everything. Out's gone Ben Davison, in comes Sugar Hill, who's been monitored, I think, or worked with for the last couple of weeks, Andy Lee. When I was out in Alabama, I spoke to Mark Kriegel from ESPN, who said to me, oh, you know, because I said, I'm not necessarily sold on Sugar Hill. I might be way off, but he said, oh, well, Andy Lee's out there. And I said, well, Andy hasn't been out there. Andy had Jay Quigley, who was fighting in LA. And then he went on a family break to Yosemite. And then I think he's been in Vegas for the last couple of weeks. I think Andy has a presence that probably would have been really good in the Fury camp for 6, 7, 8 weeks. As it is, you know, we also don't know, really. There hasn't been a lot to go on because they didn't want us filming in the gym at the time. I don't think they wanted us filming anything. We ended up doing a little bit of pads. But changes in the camp, Ben Davison to Sugar Hill. We keep hearing this thing, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And Fury won the last fight. Well, if it wasn't broke, why fix it?
But didn't he, there was a change to Ben Davison as well, wasn't there? Ben Davison wasn't Tyson's coach for his entire career. If anything, Peter Fury was the one that took Tyson all the way through. And then there was a short period of time where he worked with Ben Davison before the first fight. So I don't think that's necessarily...
Well, they had two fights, didn't they, him and
yeah,
Ben?
Yeah, but I don't necessarily think that. I think the fact that they have shared the ring together already for 12 rounds, I think has much more relevance here. It's not like he's changed from Ben Davison to another unknown entity at world level who hasn't proven that he understands the game and the business.
But Ben did a lot of work on Wilder. He knew his every nuance, knew his every move, looked at habits and all the rest of it. And it seemed like he'd come up with the antidote.
Don't get me wrong. You're asking me if making the change will be detrimental to Tyson.
I am, yes.
You're not asking me whether Ben Davison knew what he was doing or not. You're asking me about whether it's detrimental. Because remember, the time that he spent with Ben is still in his mind. It's not like he's forgotten whatever they went through. So he's got the experience of working with Ben and going through the first fight, and he's carrying that experience into a different set of circumstances. But it's not an unknown set of circumstances. Andy Lee, I've spent years with Andy, and I know what a boxing brain he has. and what an understanding and grasp he has of every element of boxing, along with Sugar Hill, who obviously grew up with Emmanuel Stewart. So the pair of them have been saturated with boxing knowledge for decades, and Tyson can feed off that and add it to what he learned and evolved with Ben. The most important thing is what he chooses to do on the night. Now that he's got this knowledge of everything he's done before, having worked with Ben, having come up with a game plan, having gone through the first 12 rounds, and working with Andy and Sugar Hill, it's great, you've got all that knowledge, but what is he going to choose to do every moment of the 12 rounds?
When fighters get to a certain level, do they stop to listen? Do they stop listening? Do they think they can coach themselves? I'm not saying that's happened, but do they?
Is there a danger? That's a blanket comment, so it'd be a blanket statement to answer that, yes or no. I think some fighters are guilty of that, and I think other champions aren't guilty of it.
Is it possible in that first fight, a lot of people thought that Tyson Fury, it had come too early for Tyson, and he did better than people thought that yes. he was doing. And therefore, more people were thinking, oh, he hasn't been wiped out, so let's give him the round. A bit like Hagler-Leonard, where people thought Hagler might blitz Leonard. And therefore, when it was close on the cards, they were like, oh, Leonard's still there. Give him that one.
Yeah,
I mean... Is there a danger that people saw that? Or, I don't know.
Well, have you gone back and scored the first fight?
Yeah, I have a few times, yeah. And I still find it very hard to give Wilder more than a couple of rounds. Certainly away from the ones with the knockdown.
Okay. So, and is that how you saw it on the night?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. Well, you answered that question for yourself.
But the fact that people see it and you saw it close makes me doubt myself. But obviously, I see it one way. And obviously, we know that boxing is down to opinions, which... I think my opinion's right. I think people who see it was a close fight, even with the knockdowns, are crazy. Sorry. But no, I don't see it as a close fight.
I said the rounds were close.
Yeah.
You can have 12 close rounds where there's hardly anything in each round and end up with a 121-108.
Sure. Seen it.
Or you can have exactly the same thing and it ends up in a 114-114.
Yeah.
It's just, you've got to score each round by itself, not take the overview.
If you're seeing a fight, though, this is one thing I'd say, and I've done enough scorecards.
You're being argumentative now.
A little bit.
Go on.
So when I've scored, I think if there've been three close rounds, right? Say round four is close. If I've given three close rounds to one guy and the fourth round's close, I'll mark it to the other guy because I think it's
trying to balance it out.
It's not. Yeah, because it's not. If they're all hair's breadth in them, I'm not going to give one guy four rounds in a fight where it could be two all. That's nuts because it's not that kind of fight.
When I score a round, when I do it, I have a piece of paper and I'll do the little lines where you do 1, 2, 3, 4 and the fifth one scores across it. So at the end of the round, you can quickly look at I gave 5, 10, 15 to him.
Yeah.
And how much him. And it's not necessarily about the punch you landed because sometimes no shots are being landed. So if you've got a period of 10 seconds where no shots are being landed, but one fella's definitely forcing it or controlling it a little bit more, I'll put a mark down for them. And then in an exchange... When I see that brief moment of time of exchange, I'll decide he came out better, he did, or it was even. And that's what I'll do. So, and then I'll go back and I'll look at the end of the round and go, oh, okay. Because if you take it as an overview of a round, just like you score a 12-round fight, 12 individual rounds, I believe you should score a three-minute round in a group of Jumps. Sections. And, and that's what I do. I remember when, was it the first Ward-Kovalev fight? And Kovalev absolutely dominated the early part of the fight. But I was scoring it and I wasn't tightening up at the end of the fight. At the end of the fight, I thought Kovalev had won until I added up my scores and I had Ward winning it by 1 point. And that for me, that was why I thought, okay, I'm glad that's how I score fights because my end result for each round is accumulation of moments through the round. And then my end result after 12 rounds is an accumulation of those accumulation of moments 12 times. So it's almost like more detailed scoring rather than just sitting there watching the round and at the end of it thinking, well, that was close. I'll give it to him. I try and break it down into sections through the round.
Maybe that's the answer for the judges. Maybe they all need little sections to mark the minutes.
Well, let's do it on Saturday.
Yeah, we could do.
We may not need it.
Could pilot it. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, we'll go on to that in a bit. It's interesting that Wilder's had these big rematches. The big rematches he's had, Stiverne and Ortiz. He's improved in the rematches, hasn't he? That either speaks volumes of Jay Diaz and his tactics or Wilder's perseverance, or can you not really say that given that what was happening in the Ortiz rematch?
Well, he made exactly, because that kind of negates that. But
he didn't have the same dangers that he faced in that
so
one.
So he's won the rematches more conclusively.
I'd say
now,
so.
Now, the Stiverne one, you could say that Stiverne got in the ring in terrible condition.
Mm-hmm.
In the rematch with Ortiz, you could say, well, actually, Ortiz was boxing his head off, and it's just because he had a lapse of concentration that allowed Deontay to land the shot. You can look at it one of two ways. You know, even when we look at the facts that we know, there's still these anomalies about them. But I'm going to go back to what I said before. He's now, Tyson Fury is probably the most awkward heavyweight to box. If you're not a wading forward type of strong, tough, pressure fighting heavyweight, if you're more of a true artist, whether it's a big puncher or a pure boxer, if you're a grade fighter, Tyson Fury is your worst nightmare. It's almost like the best way to fight Tyson is to just tuck up and bomb forward like a strong novice, because then his skills and his movement, you can negate it just by marching through the distance. So higher grade fighters struggle more with Tyson because of his style and because of his attributes. And he spent 12 rounds with him. So there's enough there for him to know or believe that he knows what little adjustments it makes, so he doesn't have to wait until the 12th round to half catch him.
It's worth mentioning here as well that Fury has done better in his rematches against John McDermott and Derek Chisora down the line. And obviously, as you say, now he's going into this where he's not coming off this incredible layoff where he abused his body and mind, really. You mentioned there about Wilder concentrating, or Ortiz and his lapse of concentration. Is this purely down? Can it be down to Fury just remaining concentrated for 12 rounds? If he stays concentrated, can he? Is it literally down to that? He's not switching off for a second?
Not going backwards
in a straight line once?
In a fight at that level, with that intensity and that stress, fighters always go through little moments where their focus isn't what it was a few moments before. It's what you do when you feel like you're not quite on it mentally with your eyes and your reactions. It's what you do. And what Ortiz did in that brief moment in time is he stood there. And that's all he needed. He stood there and his concentration wasn't quite the same, and Deontay put him to sleep. If Tyson feels that there are these lips where the intensity, he's feeling the mental, emotional and physical effects of the fight, that he just stays mobile. Because a moving target is always harder to hit than a static one.
In the first fight, some of Wilder's best shots were when he really stepped in with the jab. He really sort of was very forceful with it, but he didn't really put much in behind it. It was single shots. A lot of the Americans, I was speaking to Ben Davison about that on the way here, actually. A lot of Americans favour jabbing to the body and coming over the top with the right hand. But if Tyson just keeps moving away a little bit, then Wilder's going to find it very hard to get to the body. So part of how Deontay needs to close the gap, I would put to you, is by stepping in with the jab. But he needs to do something behind that jab.
Well, if you close the gap, if you're stepping in, you're closing the gap.
But
as long as the other fellow
doesn't
step away.
What will he do behind the jab?
You've got to disguise it. You've got to disguise it. So you don't just step in where you can see everything. You can disguise the step in with the jab or with a bit of head movement.
And I do wonder, looking at the jabs, if he wasn't getting success, I'm not sure that his jab from A to B isn't faster than Fury's single jab. So when they throw at the same time, that Deontay's...
Well, who's got the longer reach?
It's a good question.
I think Tyson. Yeah. Deontay's, I think, well, is more of an aggressive jab, yeah. But Tyson's reach is further.
Hmm.
So in taking a big step, you can actually step into a jab and give it more impact than it would do if you took a short step. It's about how I'm not a big fan of big steps, because big steps can be read. You know, if you're well out of distance, you take a big step in against a grade fighter, you can get timed against a grade fighter. You asked me something there. You said, what was it? I'll go back to something you said.
What's he put in behind the jab?
No. About him attacking the body first to set up the other shot.
Yeah.
Any of my fighters, if someone starts to target their body, the one thing I say is, do not let body shots kill your flow. So if you feel someone loading up to your body, don't focus on the fact that they're loading up on your body. Focus on the fact that that's what they're trying to do. maintain your flow, maintain your head movement, maintain your stepping. Because going to someone's body is the best way of stopping flow, because you distract them with the body shot. So if Deontay does target the body, which is the right thing to do with someone that's moving their head and moving their feet, if he does target that body with heavy shots, Tyson's adjustment has to be not to let it affect his flow.
One thing that people called for the first time, they were thinking that Tyson might box at the southpaw. We've seen it a couple of times in his career where he's boxed the entire fight as a southpaw. And we've seen that Luis Ortiz gave Wilder fits for a while as a southpaw. Again, I sort of mentioned this to Ben briefly. And I mean, it strikes me that Wilder might not have the answers to all the questions as a southpaw if Fury boxes as a southpaw.
Let's say one thing though. Ortiz is a grade southpaw. He was a grade amateur, Cuban, and he was a grade professional, and he's always been a southpaw. Everything he does, offensively and defensively, has always evolved from that southpaw stance. Yes, Tyson can switch and go right hand forward and box southpaw, if you want to call it that, and be mobile. But his natural style is orthodox. Now, if he goes southpaw, one of the answers for a southpaw is a good straight right hand. If he goes southpaw and Deontay lets a straight right hand bomb go, and Tyson's defensive movements in the southpaw position aren't as effective as they are in the orthodox position, he could make himself a sitting duck for that straight right hand. He'll only know when he presents that moment and when he sees and feels the flow of Deontay Wilder. Yes, I do think it's something he should do. But if I was speaking to Tyson, I'd say, if you're going to go southpaw, have a look from that southpaw stance out of distance. So if he wants to come with that right hand, he's got a big step it to at least give you chance to see it, read it and adjust to it. Don't switch southpaw where you're standing at distance, where all he's got to do is make a little movement and you're at range for that right hand.
Yeah, because those listening who aren't familiar with it, obviously the people say the great shot against a southpaw is the straight right hand. And then the left hook to follow up as well. Often,
but Deontay's not really a left hooker. So I don't think that the weapon of mass destruction
is that right
is hand. The right hand. Yeah. And I'm not saying ignore his left hand, absolutely not. But when he goes southpaw, you fence the lead hand anyway. So you play that sacrifice game where Tyson will use his right hand in that southpaw stance just to keep wafting away the lead hand of Deontay. So you then make it a backhand trade-off.
I'm inclined to agree with you. I've seen, obviously, Tyson box southpaw plenty of times, but it's not quite as natural. It's a little bit more forced. And the last thing you want to be doing against Wilder is forcing anything.
Not necessarily forcing. It's in that southpaw stance, his defensive movements and reactions aren't as advanced as they are in the orthodox stance. And he could get caught with a shot in that southpaw position. And if I was coaching Deontay, if I say, as soon as he goes southpaw, fence that lead hand and just drill the straight right hand as long and as hard as you can.
Okay, we're coming to a little bit of a crescendo here. Is there a danger that going into this, mindset-wise, that Fury thinks everything he's touched has turned to gold? He's had a number one album with Robbie Williams. He's had this run in the WWE. He's got this, whatever, $80 million contract with ESPN. He got up from this Terminator's biggest shots, or not biggest shots, but he got up from this Terminator when he put down. Does he think he's bulletproof? And is there a danger with that?
No, I think when you listen to Tyson talk now, he sounds much more mature and much more clear in his understanding of himself and of life, and more importantly, of bullshit. And I think when I listen to him and watch him, I think he'll know whatever's gone before is irrelevant. All that matters is what happens when that bell rings and every second of every round what he chooses to do. I think he'll be focused on the job in hand and not trying to hang on to trinkets of evidence from the past to give him fake confidence. I don't think he needs that.
Okay. So
I'm not saying that was a shit question. I'm just saying that's my answer to it.
I don't think he will
hang on little things like that.
The reason why I say that is I've seen fighters in the change. I've seen fighters change over time when they get to a certain level, they forget where they come from. And I'm not saying this happened to Tyson, but when you have all this success away from the ring and all these doors open to you and the red carpet comes out and people treat you like you're a king, then you forget the basics. It's you know, we're sat here with a picture of Rocky or a poster of the Rocky movies. We saw the success went to Rocky's head. He thought he literally had to show up and do stuff. There's a danger that these guys do live with a false sense of security when they get to a level, not just in the ring, but of fame.
Mm-hmm. I have seen complacency set into individuals that I worked with in the past. But he's stepping in with a man that put him down heavily in the 12th round of their last fight. He's stepping into the ring on Saturday night in probably the most anticipated fight this year. I think now that the AJ Andy Ruiz fight kind of fizzled out into a one-sided boxing match, everyone's now banking on this one to be the one that we really were waiting for. So with the magnitude of the event, the fact that it's a rematch, that there was a draw, that he's going into this with more confidence and more momentum behind him athletically, I would be shocked if there was an element of complacency as to how he's gone about his job.
So who wins and how?
They can both win this fight. And I don't think I'm going to be able to pick a winner with any confidence. If Tyson is going to be more assertive, he needs to be careful how he does that, because all of his defensive IQ is based on a certain flow and being careful about how he goes about the job. If all of a sudden he feels like he's punching harder, he feels stronger, he feels more confident, he feels more aggressive, yes, that could play out where he catches Deontay and actually hurts him more than he did in the first fight, but it could also mean he's there spinning the coin with Deontay and easier to hit. So if Tyson is going to be more assertive and more aggressive, he just needs to be very careful when he chooses to do it. I would always say that establish your flow first. All the great fighters can have a look at the other fella in the first round or the first couple of rounds. Let him show what's going on in his mind's eye. That's what I would say to Tyson, that if he's going to be more aggressive, make sure you set your flow first. For Deontay, we know that Deontay can be aggressive, but in this fight, it's almost the polar opposite, that he has to actually have a little bit of rhythm about him and a bit of rhythm to his steps so that he's not being left flailing and missing because Tyson's exposing his crude attacks with his defensive IQ.
The common thought is Wilder by stoppage or Fury by points. Do you agree with that? Or do you see Wilder winning on points by being busy and industrious, and Fury doing what he's saying and putting it on him and stopping him, and maybe not in two rounds, but grinding him down and physically bullying him and breaking him up?
I don't think, without knockdowns, right? Without knockdowns, let's just score each round as it goes by. I don't think, going into this fight, that Deontay can land enough punches each round and not significantly hurt or stop Tyson to win it on points. So I think Deontay's best chance to win this fight is by stoppage. I think Tyson potentially has the options of outboxing him, frustrating him, and winning the rounds. And like you said, there may be this subconscious thing now where the judges are looking at and thinking, oh, we've seen him do that before. And actually, he meant to do that and score the round for him. But he definitely stunned Deontay in the first fight. And
despite Wilder now saying that he had pillow fists and he was never hurt. Smack talk.
Yeah, you don't want to say something. Because if he turns around and says, yeah, he did, he buzzed the hell out of me. He hit me with a right hand in the seventh round. They didn't know what was going on for 30 seconds. You don't want to give your nemesis that type of confidence and momentum, because they may be thinking they're hurting you and set about you more when they're actually not. So he's got to say that. I think Deontay wins this fight by stoppage. I think Tyson can win this fight by points or by stoppage. Yes, you have to favour points more, but don't write it out that Tyson isn't going to punch harder, and he's a big man. Any man that moves and punches that's that big can be dangerous for anyone. Deontay's the bigger puncher. Tyson's the better boxer.
Is it a 50-50?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was first time round, and it is this time round, but for different reasons.
So I'm going to carry the can. So one of us has got to get off the fence. So I'm going for Wilder within six rounds. And that's, I think, with a boxing head on, when I see the guys as boxers, I pick Tyson 10 times out of 10. But I'm not confident with the changes in the team and with the setup. And I'm not sure that things are as straightforward as they seem. I just don't know. I've just got a hunch. And that's all, you know, I think obviously I'm not going out. We weren't able to see Tyson sparring or train for that matter. So I'm sort of reaching here. But even the fact that we couldn't go and see any training makes me curious. And the fact that what the footage that we have seen was of Tyson doing pads with Sugar Hill as a southpaw, where Tyson was boxing a southpaw, then that leads me to think that maybe they'll think that that will be the way forward, and I don't think it is on the night.
If anyone's going to play with the media and throw out red herrings, it's going to be Tyson.
Sure, but maybe that was not intended. I don't know, but I'm not sure. You know, I'm not sure that the guys were even going to be filming then. It's fascinating.
But you do it, and when you have these little moments in time, you do it knowing that the other coach is going to watch it, and the other coach is going to say to the fire, "Look, he's going southpaw," and then you might before you even step to the ring, you might then readjust what they're preparing for, knowing full well that you're not going to fight southpaw, but you're making them second guess it. You know, and I do think Tyson is a modern day master of that psychology.
Yeah, for sure. I do. I think I'm going to go, but with the law of averages, that Wilder needs to win 1 second of 12 rounds. I see Wilder winning 1 second of the round. Big. Whether or I don't know, right or wrong, but that's my gut.
I'm good, yeah, and that's been my gut feeling. But then I think about the fact that Tyson has to be a more confident fighter going into this fight than he was the first one. He has to be, because look at the state he was in going into that first fight.
I'm more confident for Tyson going into this one than I was the first time.
But that confidence can work against you. If you let yourself get carried away with it, you must never forget what your style is and what your best attributes are, regardless of how much harder you think you're punching, regardless of how much fitter you think you are, regardless of how much more confident you believe you are. You've always got to remember and maintain what works best for you. And if Tyson's going in there thinking, do you know what? I hurt him the first time. I know I can hurt him. And I feel stronger. I feel more confident. I'm going to stand there. I'm going to let him know his boss. To do that against probably the hardest puncher in the heavyweight division, that could be a bad decision to make. And if he does that, I favour Deontay.
It's absolutely fascinating. And I'm glad to say that I'll be back here for fight night to watch it with you. And we'll have our first proper official YouTube offering out on Sunday morning or around lunchtime on Sunday, which will be our post-fight breakdown and our reactions to the fight as the fight's going on, which I'm really looking forward to. Really enjoyed this breakdown today. Thank you very much for having me. As always, much appreciated. I couldn't really get you off the fence, but that's absolutely fine. I understand what you said. I actually was messaging Red Terence Crawford's trainer last night, and just in passing, I said, who do you think's going to win? And he said, I'm not going to make a pick. I'm just going to enjoy the fight. I think people don't let you forget your worst predictions. And if you just want to enjoy it, just enjoy it. I know that as Boxing News editor.
I got personal interest in this as well because we've had Deontay overtrain with us a few times. And also Deontay is very good friends with Richard Towers. And so, you know, I've had Deontay on FaceTime speaking to my daughters. But equally, I was as close to Andy Lee as I've ever been with any fighter. He lived with me for 3 years. We shared every day together, and he now has his personal investment in Tyson Fury and his passion for it. So I'm not just sitting on the fence because justifiably I am. I'm sitting on the fence personally because I've got the connection to the two of them.
No, I fully understand it. But I think what you've said, I think people will be able to make up their own minds and go and spread their bets across both sides. But no, thank you very much for your time, Adam. Greatly appreciated.
That's all.